Every year in the United States, more than 800 people are killed by trains. Some of them are trespassing on the tracks, others are struck at crossings. These deaths are tragic not only for the families of those killed, but also for locomotive engineers who drive the trains. And the railroads have developed programs to help engineers cope. Nancy Cohen visited with one group of engineers who work for the Mass Bay Commuter Rail in Boston.
Locomotive engineer Walter Nutter can still remember peering through the dull light of dawn one morning 16 years ago. His freight train had just rounded a curve when he saw something on the tracks.
And my conductor and I were looking at it. We're coming up to it. We're only going 30 miles an hour, and we couldn't tell what it was. We thought it was a big piece of cardboard. And as we got closer to it, we realized it was a body. And by then, it was too late.
It was Walter Nutter's first fatality.
You can't erase that event from anybody's memory. Once you've had a fatality, it's with you, I think, for the rest of your life.
This is the kind of risk all locomotive engineers face. People take shortcuts across the tracks. Pedestrians and cars ignore warnings at railroad crossings. Children play on rail beds and teenagers hang out. And there are suicides. Like Walter Nutter, engineer Ray McGrath has had his share of fatalities, two in 16 years. But on a blue sky morning, the mustached 54-year-old is smiling as he glides his train out of Worcester Station towards Boston.
The daycare out of that church, the kids are there every day waving at you. I start so early in the morning, you see some of the beautiful, most beautiful sunrises that you can imagine.
McGrath looks out on a snow-covered rail bed that snakes past birch and pine trees like a road through the woods. But the view from the engineer's seat can also be tragic. Trains are heavy machines. It can take more than a quarter of a mile before they can stop, and they can't swerve out of the way. After a fatality, an engineer can feel severe guilt, depression, or anger.
You know, when it first happened, you're just so mad. You can't even talk. You're so mad that why people do that. And then you just eventually realize that you just happen to be the engineer that day on that train.
McGrath says he received phone calls from his coworkers who had also had fatalities.
You get over it. Now the engineers that call you up just makes it everything more easier all the time. Every day you get a little better.
Some of the engineers who called McGrath had received special training to help co-workers get through a fatal incident. Walter Nutter helped start this volunteer peer support program about 9 years ago. Back when Nutter had his first fatality in 1988, there was no one to help him. His train had hit a 23-year-old man.
When I heard how old he was, my knees buckled. It just rattled me. But back in those days, we got back on the horse. You got back in the engine, you kept driving your train, just like nothing had ever happened.
Today, things are different. At Mass Bay, the engineer is sent home and can take time off. And everyone knows after a fatality to call Walter.
I'll ask them how they're doing, and I'll try to gauge how they're doing by how their voice sounds. And we try to make an assessment. And we're not professionals by any stretch of the imagination. We're just railroad engineers.
But they're railroad engineers trained to listen to a colleague after a fatal accident. Railroad engineers who know how long it takes to stop a train, who know the event will play over and over in one's mind, like a video stuck in instant replay. They're also trained to recognize when someone should get professional counseling. And when an engineer returns to work, a peer supporter can explain what to expect.
They might experience what we call hypervigilance when they get to that spot where the accident happened, because the chances are they're going to go by it again, that they'll approach that place and there'll be sort of a build-up of emotion and then they'll get by it.
That's what happens to Ray McGrath just before a bridge east of Worcester.
When I come into that spot, I'm always looking to see if there's someone there.
That's because 4 years ago, when McGrath approached that spot, he saw a man wearing a hooded sweatshirt. His train was going nearly 60 miles an hour.
This bridge is where I hit him right here. So I was going west. He was standing behind that bridge abutment on the left-hand side, and he just walked in front of me.
Walter Nutter says the 30 to 40 seconds it can take to stop a train can stretch like a gruesome nightmare.
You have to ride as it goes over the person and until the train stops. And it's really very tough. Through no fault of your own or through no choice of your own, you're involved in the loss of a human life. And so it's difficult to face.
May I have your attention, please? This is the final boarding call for the 5:30 Worcester train on track 3.
It's rush hour at South Station in Boston. Walter Nutter is sitting high in a westbound locomotive. The setting sun lights up his face and reflects off the tracks below. Nutter moves his train past big orange signs warning people to stay off the rail bed.
We're coming up here to Yawkey Station. We have Fenway Park over here on the left.
Nutter's body is alert, his right hand on the throttle, his left on the bright red emergency brake. In the suburbs outside of Boston, footprints cross the tracks. People take a shortcut around a fence to a parking lot.
There's a guy, I don't know if you can look at my mirror, there's a guy that's going to walk around right now.
Nutter wishes everyone would stay off the tracks. He can still picture a lanky, elderly man poking through a fence and turning to look at Nutter's train before trying to make it across. And he'll never forget the exact curve on this track where a 38-year-old woman used his train to kill herself.
It was dark. It was in October. It was pitch black. Her clothes kind of blended in with everything.
Nutter never saw her face, just her back and the curly hair that fell below her shoulders.
As soon as I saw it, I could tell it was a suicide because I started blowing the whistle and putting the brake on, and she didn't budge. And I just stood up in the engine and I'm screaming, no, no, you know, as loud as I could, top of my lungs. And I put the train in emergency and we hit her. And it was, for me, it was the hardest one, maybe because I saw it for, it seemed like for a long time before it actually happened. And she just never budged. And to me, I can't imagine, I can't comprehend being able to do that. This whistle, it's ear-piercing, and people fall to their knees and put their hands in their ears because the whistles are so loud. And she just stood there and never flinched.
All Nutter could do was hit the emergency brake.
I was so helpless, you know, and you feel just so helpless. You want to be able to jump out and push her out of the way, and you can't.
This time it was Nutter who got a call from a peer supporter. It helped, but that night is still seared in his memory.
Whether it's a suicide or an accident, pure accident, it makes a little bit of a difference, but in the end, it's all the same. Somebody's lost their life, you know, before they should have. P527, departing West Natick.
It's dark as Nutter's train heads west. Its headlights flash across the faded paint of a passing freight train. Engineers find a way to go back to work after a fatality. With time, these deaths may no longer trouble them. But they did happen, and the memory always remains. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Cohen.